This talk was given by Mr. Vince Nesbitt. The subject, Humanism in Education.
Madam Chairman, ladies and gentlemen. We're talking about humanism in education. We've got plenty of signs of it bobbing up here, but most of the information I have is derived from the USA. And there's a reason for this. In the USA, the process of humanizing the education system is almost complete. And the result is that those who are behind it are so convinced that the process is irreversible that they are writing books about what they're doing and really blowing the whole story. I think if you're going to understand new education, you have to understand that it is part of a revolutionary process. If you don't understand this, you don't understand anything about it at all. And it is my job this evening to set it into this focus, into this perspective. And I'll take you back to what Arnold Toynbee said as early as about, I think it was 1969, that we live today in a state of perpetual revolution. And this seemed somewhat paradoxical because we always see revolution as abrupt and violent and overturning social institutions. But what he was talking about was a revolution of values which is continuous. The Humanist Manifesto, number 2, says, the true revolution is occurring and can continue in countless non-violent adjustments. There are two major thrusts of this revolution. There's the old left, which is familiar to most of us, and the new left, which is not familiar to all of us. It's a very diffuse movement. It brings about all sorts of strange bedfellows. You find the wharf labourer linked up with the homosexual. You find the trade unionist linked up with the big business, the big tax-free foundations of the US particularly. You find women's liberation linked up with the Playboy Foundation. It's full of paradox. And once you begin to understand this, once you begin to understand the forces that are behind it, you will see the reasons for this too. Now, I want to show you a comparison, and I'll run through it fairly quickly, that was made between the new and the old left by Professor Lovibond at a symposium at the University of New South Wales that was called Liberation Movements in Psychiatry. He divided the left up in under quite a few headings, and he borrowed from a gentleman called Maus, M-A-U-S-S, and I'm going to borrow from him with acknowledgement. In its origins, the old left went to manual workers and some intelligentsia. The new left goes to the students and graduates. It is a bourgeois movement, an intellective movement, if you like. The allies of the old left were the manual workers and trade unionists. Of the new left, the dispossessed and what it calls the oppressed. The targets of the old left were the bourgeoisie and the owners of the means of production and provision of services. Of the new left, it is what it calls the establishment, the military-industrial complex and authority in any form, that is, government, the police, teachers, and especially parents. The new left is aimed dead set at the family. The old left was ideologically very strong. It was Marxist, it was Fabian, and the new left is weak, it's libertarian, and therefore finally anarchistic, and it is humanist. The old left struggled against social injustices, the inequalities, if you like, between the classes, the struggle between labour and capital. The new left is aimed at middle-class values, as it calls them, and practices, and we would say that these were Judeo-Christian values. The methods of the old left were planned and rational. The old left had a good understanding of politics and worked through the political mechanism. The new left is looking for immediate action based on experience and feeling. And if we had no other evidence than this, it would be sufficient to show that it was spearheaded by humanism. The attitude of the old left was highly disciplined. It put the cause before all else. Douglas Hyde tells us that during the Second World War, the communists in Great Britain stood up to their ankles in the snow, handing out leaflets for which they had paid themselves by contributing something like a third of their weekly wage. In Japan, the Communist Party takes 1% of the annual wage of its members. The new left, on the other hand, looks for individual autonomy. Now, this is a word that comes up all the time in humanist literature. And it looks for personal rights, for example, sexual rights. The characters of the old left were completely reversed by the new left. The old left was historical. It believed that everything was historically determined, especially economic matters, and economic matters controlled most things. It was collectivist. It believed in the equality of all men, and it looked to the future. In fact, communism will only occur when men have learned to live together in brotherhood and the state will have withered away. Then we'll have communism. There's no communism in the world today, so it had to look to the future, because what it proposes is nothing more or less than pie in the sky. People are not going to be given control and then wither away. The new left is ahistorical. It says history begins today, it begins right here. It is individualist, although in a sense it eschews individualism, because it says this is against world government. And it is very much present-oriented. It wants everything now, and it jumps up and down the one spot demanding it. The aims of the old left with regard to government were for a centralized socialist government to protect the rights of the workers during the dictatorship of the proletariat. But the new left wants decentralized government. It wants to share in the decision-making and is prepared to bypass what we call the democratic process to get it. In race relations, the old left, because it was egalitarian, was integrationist. Everybody was to live together, whatever their color, whatever their anything else. The new left is separatist. It wants black power, it wants yellow power, it wants woman power, it wants pufta power, as it calls it. It wants a whole series of small cells in society, each looking for its own personal rights. The old left worked through industrial strikes, lockouts. The new left works through demonstrations, sit-ins, teach-ins, love-ins, and is determined to confront the oppressor with the oppressed in public. Now, I think it is a big jump to say that the new left is intellectually spearheaded by scientific humanism, or secular humanism, or evolutionary humanism, or any of the other names under which atheistic humanism goes. I cannot trace this for you this evening because there's insufficient time. But I will make the assertion, and if you don't accept it, well, that's my bad luck. But I would say that the new left is intellectually spearheaded in its aims and its objectives and its methods by scientific humanism. And I will give you here a definition of what scientific humanism is. Scientific or secular humanism is an all-encompassing philosophy. That's most important. It is a philosophy that says there's no God. Every man's his own creator, every man's his own savior. There are no absolutes, especially no absolute truth, nor absolute morality, no absolute right or wrong, and no absolute authority. There must be no patriotism nor nationalism, because secular humanism believes in one world government. There was a question asked on Monday conference, what's wrong with humanism? And the answer is, if you're a humanist, there's nothing wrong with it. But I think that I must make it quite clear to you that I have no contention with humanists as persons. I know quite a few of them. I have half a dozen friends at least who are humanists in the formal way. I don't agree with them. That doesn't stop me loving them. As persons, I think they can teach us a lot. They're admirable in their attention to what they think is best for the world, in the efforts that they make in trying to bring this about. But Aristotle said, how a man will view some end depends upon the sort of man that he is. What sort of man? That sort of end, that sort of view of an end. So we will act, he says, very much as we are. The humanists have published two manifestos, one in 1933 and one in 1973. And this demonstrates, I think, very well, if we read through these two humanist manifestos, where secular humanists and Christians part company. And I'll read you a few abstracts from them. In the first humanist manifesto, the eighth affirmation, religious humanism considers the complete realization of human personality to be the end of man's life. Now, that is end in the sense of the good for which something is made, is done, or exists, or is changed. That sort of end, not the termination. And seeks its development and fulfillment in the here and now. It is present-oriented, as we saw. Second Humanist Manifesto, in the preamble. As in 1933, humanists still believe that traditional theism, especially faith in a prayer-hearing God, assumed to love and care for persons. to hear and understand their prayers and to be able to do something about them is an unproved and outmoded faith. Again, in the preface, salvationism, based on mere affirmation, still appears as harmful, diverting people with false hopes of heaven hereafter. The first affirmation in the second manifesto, humans are responsible for what we are or will become. Now that's written in italics. No deity will save us, we must save ourselves. The second affirmation, science affirms that the human species is an emergence from natural evolutionary forces. The third affirmation, moral values derive their source from human experience. Ethics is autonomous and situational, needing no theological or ideological sanction. The sixth affirmation speaks of the right to birth control, abortion and divorce should be recognized. The many varieties of sexual exploration should not in themselves be considered evil, which it puts in inverted commas. The seventh affirmation speaks of a recognition of an individual's right to die with dignity, euthanasia and the right to suicide. And the 11th, innovative and experimental forms of education are to be welcomed, and are here. Now, embedded in these statements are many things that Christians could accept. For example, they speak of concern for the welfare of the aged, the infirm, the disadvantaged, the mentally retarded, the abandoned or abused children, handicaps, the handicapped and addicts. But these are very seldom, if ever, translated into practical fact or institutions. There are two possible reasons why we don't find humanist homes for the aged or the infirm or for orphans or for unmarried mothers. The first is that they are very small in numbers, tiny in numbers in proportion to their effect in the world. The second is that they seem to use death-dealing methods to solve all social problems. So they want abortion, they want infanticide, they want euthanasia. That's the way you get rid of your problems. We'll see why. Now, the second Humanist Manifesto said that the next century can be and should be the humanist century. And there's every chance that if we don't get up on our hind legs, it may be. It affirms a set of common principles stated to be a design for a secular society on a planetary scale. It wants a humanist world, and it's to be a collectivist society. A collectivist society is organized much like an ant heap. You have the individual is there only for the sake of the whole. The individual is for the sake of society. And you have the queen at the head of it, and then you have the ants in the heap. And what happens to them can only relate to what is required by the ant heap. Secular humanism has been declared by two cases in the US Supreme Court to be a non-theistic religion. The first was the Torcaso case in 1961, the second the Seeger case in 1964. That is rather a strange sort of a statement to be made by a court, that we have a non-theistic religion. But if we are going to have the sort of world that the humanists are looking for, one world, we've got to have one world religion to begin with, and that would be non-theistic. But before we get to religion, if we're going to live in the way that they say that man ought to live, in his fulfilled way, with every man doing what he wants to do and nobody getting hurt, that's the only measure that nobody gets hurt, then you're going to come up against the law. Where the law impinges upon the moral order, you'll find that it deals with many of the items on the program of humanists. In the early 1960s, the British Humanist Association brought out a series of resolutions which constituted a plan for law change, a campaign for political action. The first was for the decriminalisation of homosexual acts between consenting adults in private. Now, this is not where it ends, of course. They want a homosexual society in which people are allowed to live in stable homosexual relationships that will be recognised by the state as marriages. They want the right to adopt children, for example. They want their spouse to be defined as such, and this has all sorts of implications for inheritance, etc. The second item on the programme was the provision of easy divorce when a marriage can be shown to have broken down. The third, abortion on demand, and they say free. I say at somebody else's expense. I can't see how that could work out. The fourth is legal euthanasia, and not euthanasia as we understand it, the removal of extraordinary measures of maintaining life once the process of death has reached an irreversible state. That's the way I would define euthanasia. But they talk about direct and positive killing. H.J. Blackham's a leading humanist writer, and he said that we must have euthanasia in three phases. Firstly, voluntary, and this is the one being pushed for now, and we have voluntary euthanasia societies in every state of Australia who are preparing legislation. But when the first euthanasia bill went through the House of Lords, and there have been six, Lord Chorley said that some people would think this bill doesn't go far enough, but we must go step by step. Now, the first step is voluntary euthanasia, and this is when somebody decides that for his own good, he will let somebody kill him. Second is involuntary euthanasia, when somebody else makes this decision for him. And thirdly, compulsory euthanasia, when somebody else decides that for somebody else's good, he should be killed. So these are the three phases of euthanasia legislation. The fifth item on the program is the removal of all restrictions from what they call soft drugs. The sixth, the abolition of censorship. And the seventh, the abolition of the teaching of religion in schools. That's their seven-point program. You would understand that since the early 60s, they have made a lot of progress, even here. Certainly they've made a lot of progress throughout the world. It's a big question mark as to how a person can sustain a religion which is non-theistic. But there are quite a few non-theistic religions in the world. Taoism, Buddhism, these are non-theistic. But Robert Schnitzgebel of Pitzer College, I think, spoke of the sort of religion that most humanists are thinking about. He said we need a new religion which will honour the external, the environment we create for ourselves, and the things we invent. We must worship, he said, the work of our hands. Now that is the idolatry of the technocrat. That is the religion of the future as the humanist sees it. I mentioned that humanists want one world government. Arnold Toynbee some time ago drew out the progress of civilizations. They have their genesis, they grow, they break down. They undergo a time of trouble, they evolve into a universal state, and then they finally collapse, and then they stagger to their feet and start all over again. Now there are many people today who believe that this process can be altered, can be arrested after the stage of growth before it begins to break down. And this is what is being pushed. One world, one species is the motto. The United Nations was set up by humanists. The Constitution of the United Nations was written by a number of people who were members of the Council for Foreign Relations in the USA, all identifiable as humanists, some identifiable as communists. And it is based on the Constitution of the USSR. I'll mention here that not all humanists are communists. Some are strongly anti-communists, but all humanists whose works I've read have been socialists. Now, UNESCO was one of the bodies of the United Nations that had as its original head Julian Huxley, who is one of the most famous of humanist writers. UNESCO, in a publication, said that we are looking for a new type of man for the future. Educational strategies are now being worked out to produce such a man. And René Mayhew, in fact, all of UNESCO's activities are designed to facilitate the advent of a civilization of the universal. That was said when he was Director General of UNESCO. A civilization of the universal simply says one world government. Now, I think if you're going to take the world over, then you have to look to the future. And it was almost inevitable that humanism should move in as a revolutionary process into the educational setup. And as long ago as 1930, a statement was made by the Reverend Charles Francis Potter. Reverend Potter was a subscriber to the first Humanist Manifesto. He was one of the people who signed it. And he was the leader and the founder of the first Humanist Society of New York, and a founder of the American Euthanasia Society, which was later termed the American Good Death Society. And this is what he had to say. Education is thus a most powerful ally of humanism, and every American public school is a school of humanism. What can the theistic Sunday schools, meeting for an hour once a week and teaching only a fraction of the children, do to stem the tide of a five-day program of humanistic teaching? There he's blown it, back in 1930, that this is what education is all about in the US. Scott Nearing, who was a disciple of John Dewey and one of the architects of the UN Charter, said this: "The public schools must become the vehicle for revolution. If not now, then 40 years hence." And he said that over 40 years ago. So I thought that I might trace with you some of the early history of the new education, humanistic education, and try to show that, as in most things, a lot of it is not new. Some of it goes back a long time, and try to picture up for you the constant conflict that goes on within the world. Here I have set out the origins of new education, and in the middle have placed scientific humanism, because I think that it would be fair to say that the history of new education is the history of humanism, or is a humanistic history. And I'm going to take you back 24 centuries to Socrates. He said that children should be educated through unchanging principles by the disciplines of education, intellectual discipline, in other words. Plato, who was one of his students, said that man needs to be ruled. He's not capable of self-government. And he drew up his plan for what he called the Republic, which was to be ruled by philosopher kings, guarded by the warriors, and run by some poorly educated labourers and artisans. In other words, he pictured an elitism. Aristotle, who was his student, said that if this were to be done, we're going to ask people to submit themselves to the slavery by philosopher kings. We're going to ask them to submit themselves to a type of society that would be destructive of the family. And he said it would have to be done by fraud and deceit of demagogues. And he said if children are not educated in the constitution and the laws, they are certain to fall under a police state ruled by tyrants. And this is the ancient conflict that persists right through this time. The conflict between the idea of free society based on the free individual person and on a totalitarian order based on a centralized power and collectivism. This is the struggle which is still going on in the world that began as long ago as that. We jump now down to the 18th century, to Jean-Jacques Rousseau. He was a man who worked through fraud and deceit, and he concentrated on the children. He'd written a book called Emile. Emile used to be required reading for people undergoing training as a teacher. It told of a boy who was raised without discipline. He had no books, he had no verbal lessons, and he learned by doing, and he ended up as a savage. And Rousseau promoted among the young people very much the same cluster of ideas that we find today amongst the hippies. He asked them to return to nature. He introduced them to communal living and to group marriage and the rejection of private property. Everything belongs to everybody. He also wrote a book called The Social Contract, which is becoming more and more often quoted today. And he manipulated the French masses. He aroused class hatred, and like all revolutionaries, he promised them a share of the wealth. Share of the wealth, of course, is just a furphy. You could share the wealth out equally, and in no time the Sharpies would have it all again. But he espoused the underlying slogan, if you like, of the French Revolution: liberty, equality, and fraternity, based on terrorism. Terrorism is not killing those whom you hate, it is not killing your enemies, it is not killing the classes you wish to eliminate. Terrorism is indiscriminate killing. It is killing to arouse fear in the hearts of everybody, because they know if they don't go along with what you're doing, they themselves will be killed. This is what terrorism is all about. This is what the Red Guards are all about. There were three factors in the French Revolution. There were the big financiers who provided the money, there were the permissive educators who prepared the way, and the political philosophy of socialism. And this again is persisting right down to our day. In modern education, you have the permissive educators, you have the socialist philosophy, and you have the money of the big tax-exempt foundations, like Ford, Rockefeller, Carnegie, and a few others. So it goes back quite a long way. Now, Rousseau knew that if he was going to use this fraud, he would have to rewrite history. So he linked up with the encyclopedists, with Voltaire, Diderot, D'Alembert, to rewrite history. Along came a gentleman called Weishaupt, interesting character. He was a Jew, became a Catholic, became a Jesuit priest, and was a lecturer in theology. Some say he then became a Satanist. I'm unsure about that. There's some conflict in the literature. But he set up an organization called the Illuminati, the Enlightened Ones, and he drew these mainly from intellectuals, men of great power as well, but he linked up the encyclopedists with big money. He linked them up with the House of Rothschild, which was then fairly new. Rothschild comes from a red shield, and that was their crest. I'm not saying that the Jews are responsible any more than anybody else for the revolution in the world. It just happened to be that way, that they were the people at that time who were the big money. The Illuminati were founded on the 1st of May, 1776, and that is celebrated as May Day in every socialist country. It's celebrated in some parts of Australia, too. They, following Weishaupt, espoused liberty and equality on the ruins of religion and property. That was one of Weishaupt's statements. Down to Georg Hegel. He was a sort of father philosopher of Germany. Marx got kicked out of Germany because he wrote an article criticizing Hegel. He wrote under a false name, but somebody shopped him. And he got tipped out of Germany for this reason. Hegel is known for his statement, "The state is God." He promoted the value of war for maintaining a strong centralized government. And he quoted Rousseau, "It is by public education that minds are given a national form." And he gave us dialectics. He gave us idealistic dialectics, or dialectic idealism, which simply says that ideas work out their own implication. Ideas work between two minds by a thesis being put up, an antithesis is proposed, the argument, the dialectic, sorts out the truth in both, and you come up with a conclusion which becomes the next thesis. So he said this is the way we work through dialectic. But he said ideas do this by themselves, independently of people, independently of mind, independently of intellect. Ideas work out their own implications, and then they come into being, but their own implications are worked out. It's nutty, but there it was. And this was very attractive to Marx. He had wanted to be a materialist, but he found the materialism of the 18th century very static things, very cold sort of materialism. And when he heard Hegel, he became very excited. He said, "I'll turn Hegel on his head. I will have a dialectical materialism in which things work out their own implications and come into being." And this was taken up by others later on, of course. So we can say that Hegel gave us communism and National Socialism, because he gave us the dialectic. And he also gave us what's very important, that modern existentialism. And this is the philosophy of humanism. Modern existentialism is one of the wilder existentialisms. There are some quite valid existentialisms proposed. But it says, in a sense, that man is trapped in an existence over which he has no control, and he can only hope to struggle up out of it partly. Modern existentialism is a philosophy of becoming. It says that existence precedes essence. It says that something is before it is what it is. And you might think this is harmless ranting. But when you tie this up with the humanist program, you can see how important it is, because it says that man is not conceived man. H.J. Blackham says that man becomes human through being socialized. Now, if you look in the new humanist education, you will find, for example, in the MACOS, Man A Course of Study books, that one way of humanizing people is to educate them. Now, if you see man as not being conceived human, nor gestated human, nor born human, but he may become human, then this opens the way, of course, to treating some men as not being human. And so this opens the way to abortion, to infanticide, and to euthanasia. A man can become subhuman by losing part of his socialization, by getting knocked on the head, by becoming ill, by becoming old. And so he would become subhuman. what society would destroy, it first must declare to be subhuman. We have not yet got to the stage where you can kill people and get away with it. But if you declare them to be subhuman, as the lady said about the concentration camp, a friend of mine lived in Germany, and she said to a woman, "Now, you lived alongside this concentration camp. Didn't you know what was going on?" She said, "Oh, yes, we knew. But we were told they weren't human." And that opens the door to everything. So that's most important, that simple error in philosophy. And this is what you must watch for in any philosophy, that a hair's breadth deviation from the truth in principle leads to a world's breadth in conclusion. The tiniest error in philosophy can lead to chaos, it can lead to destruction of the world and everybody in it. Fichte, Johann Fichte. Educators, he said, are the real parents. That's turning things upside down. Educators are the real parents. He said that reading should be postponed, and he'd put the guidance of the states in the hands of the state in the hands of the philosopher kings. He said that teachers should select the elite to succeed them from among their students. This is the process going on in the US today. Certain students are set aside and given special treatment because they are going to be the leaders of the community. This is the big force of third force psychology, is the selection of those people that are the cutting edge of society, the growing tip of society. Bertrand Russell, in his book The Impact of Science on Society, wrote, "Fichte laid it down that education should aim at destroying free will, so that after pupils are thus skilled, they will be incapable throughout the rest of their lives of thinking or acting otherwise than as their schoolmasters would have wished." That's Fichte's idea of things. Mikhail Bakunin taught terrorism. He taught anarchy and nihilism, which is the extreme anarchy. He taught young people particularly how to go about bombing, kidnap, murder, insurrection. He wanted a police state ruled by guess who? Philosopher kings. He was very impressed by Hegel, and he ultimized, if you like, Rousseau's hedonistic back to nature thing. He wrote The Catechism of the Revolutionary, which is the book that's used by the Black Panthers. That is their guidebook. I'll read you an excerpt from it. "The revolutionary despises and hates all morals. For him, all is moral, which favors the triumph of revolution, and immoral and criminal, which impedes it. He must live in the midst of society, feigning to be what he is not. He must penetrate everywhere, among the upper classes and among the middle, in the shop, the church, the army, the literary world, the secret police." Lenin called him the darling of the party. About this time, bobbed up Charles Darwin, an honest biologist who published a theory. It was caught up by the rationalists, who mistakenly enough believed that this would eliminate the need for God. If things just evolved of themselves, they said, we don't need God. The evolutionary theory has been blown apart by a dozen writers. It is scientifically bankrupt. It just doesn't exist anymore, except in schools and in universities. May I borrow that book back from your head and quote from it? It's a quote I ran across the other day. Thanks. "The theory of evolution is no longer with us because neo-Darwinism is now acknowledged as being unable to explain anything more than trivial change. And in default of some other theory, we have none. Despite the hostility of the witness provided by the fossil records, despite the innumerable difficulties, and despite the lack of even a credible theory, evolution survives. Can there be any other area of science, for instance, in which a concept as intellectually barren as embryonic recapitulation could be used as evidence for theory?" This is the theory by which you look at an embryo and you say, "Oh, it looks like a fish. It's got gills and a tail. So therefore the human was once a fish because he's going through the stages again." Well, the gills are the brachial arches and they become very important organs. It's nothing to do with it. They don't act as gills. It just happens to be the particular shape of the embryo at that stage. It doesn't indicate anything at all. And more of that. But it's still continued on because, if man evolved, as Darwin has suggested, and the neo-Darwinians have...
extended the theory, from a series of tiny changes over a long time in a large population, then there's no way that you can sustain the idea that man was created perfect and then fell through original sin. There's no place for original sin in that sort of theory. Now, if there's no original sin, there's no need for redemption, and Christianity collapses. And that is why evolution has been sustained, because it's anti-Christian. There's no scientific reason for sustaining it. And modern genetics have hit it on the head even harder. It's been shown by Professor Jerome Lejeune, for example, that the sort of evolution required to come from a monkey into man just could not have occurred. Not that way. You'd have to go in a jump. You'd have to go in about 24 jumps, actually. Pestalozzi was a very well-regarded man, Johann Pestalozzi. He set up the orphan schools in Switzerland, and he had a strong influence on many English educators and on some American ones, as we see. Now, he was very impressed by Emile, and he reared his son the same way, and he wrote up the story in what he called a father's journal. His children in the orphan schools didn't get any reading and writing to speak of. He thought that was very unimportant. And he taught them by object lessons. He'd hand them something and ask them to examine it. And he also espoused Rousseau's return to nature and the learning by doing and no grammar. And he collaborated with Fichte. And he strongly influenced Horace Mann. Now, Horace Mann was the father of permissive education in the US. Dewey often gets credit for this, but Horace Mann was the man set up the 2-year normal school for teachers, and he based this on the Pestalozzi system, and he says that education should be universal and sectarian. Over here we have the advent in 1883, between 1883 and 1884, of the Fabian Society in England. This is a fascinating organization. It hides. You won't find much written about the Fabian Society. Any of its members who write have got to accept responsibility for what they write. There are a few books, but not a lot. The Fabian Society is probably one of the most powerful revolutionary forces in the world today, and has been. They did not want the continuation of the idea of violent revolution. They said that would not work in a place like England. So they looked instead for an evolution, a peaceful evolution, and a penetration of society. Much like Bakunin's revolutionary. He's got to be and seem what he is not. He's got to hide. He's got to penetrate. A quote here: much of the impact of Fabianism has been through the gradual permeation of Fabian ideas among teachers, civil servants, politicians, trade union officials, and others in influential positions. This was the idea, to get people of socialistic bent into positions of influence in society, and by gradualism, to change the climate of opinion. One of the founders of the Fabian Society, Sidney Webb, wrote a book called The Inevitability of the Gradual, and this erosion system has been used through the media to change values in our country as well. The Fabians moved across in September 1905 to the USA, and you may be interested to hear the names of some of the members of the Fabian branch over there. Jack London, Clarence Darrow, Walter Lippmann, Walter Reuther, Eugene Debs, Francis Perkins, W.E.B. Du Bois, they call him over there, Norman Thomas, and John Dewey. Now, that is a list of communists and of humanists. Dewey is a fascinating man. He is the founder, if you like, of what became known as progressive education. And by 1905, he'd become the dominant voice in teacher training in the US. He was at Columbia University, had a strong influence on the educational faculty at Harvard and many other universities. He was the first president of the American Humanist Society, and he signed the first Humanist Manifesto, and he was also a National Socialist. He believed in 100% state control of all the means of production, that is, natural resources, capital, and labor, and he called this collectivism. In 1905, he organized the Intercollegiate Socialist Society with Jack London, Upton Sinclair, Walter Lippmann, and W.E.B. Du Bois. By the early 20s, the word socialist had become unpopular, and they changed the name to the League for Industrial Democracy. Dewey was the president in 1941, I think before that as well. In 1962, the League for Industrial Democracy set up a political action arm which was called the Students for Democratic Society. And these were the young people who led the revolution, the outrages that occurred during the student movement in the middle 60s in the US. The League for Industrial Democracy had an aim of putting collectivists in the classroom as teachers, in the pulpits as preachers, and in the labour unions as leaders. Now there's the Fabian influence upon them. In the early 1900s, they had formed the Progressive Education Association and the American Association of University Professors. This is Dewey and his companions. Both of these organisations were committed to the goal of collectivising the USA. Dewey, as the father of progressive education, is said to have assigned to schools the revolutionary mission of reforming society. He changed the aim and the method and the content of education, and he worked through the social studies courses, which to be a child-centered, do-your-own-thing personal development affair. After the Second World War, the aim became the global collectivist society. Dewey was a good humanist. He said there is no God, there is no soul, there's no room for fixed natural law or permanent moral absolutes. So I think that when we look at progressive education in the US, this no grading, no set curriculum we have down here is the two major features of it, we've got to see the beginning of the revolution in education. Weaver, in his Visions of Order, says this: it is not too much to say that in the past 50 years, public education in the United States has been in the hands of revolutionaries.
Weaver, in his Visions of Order, says this: it is not too much to say that in the past 50 years, public education in the United States has been in the hands of revolutionaries. I think it ought to be made clear at this stage that in no way am I directing specific criticism at modern educational methods. Firstly, I don't know enough about them. Secondly, I think they're largely unproven. But I will say this, that if you have the most perfect system of teaching and the underlying philosophy is faulty, then the best you can do is a perfect job of turning out a bad product. It's the underlying philosophy that's important in education, and this is what I think is faulty. Here are some of the humanists in US education. I think you ought to be familiar with some of these names. Horace Mann, who brought about universal sectarian education. John Dewey, who saw the schools as agents of change, social change. Dr. George Counts, who introduced the social studies courses. Dr. Abram Maslow, he's the third course psychologist. He's associated with the National Training Laboratories, responsible for a lot of the social engineering, if you like, and the National Education Association. Jacob Moreno, who introduced psychodrama and sociograms, he's the man who said the way to get rid of God is to act him out. Dr. Carl Rogers, who set up the encounter groups. Willard Maynard and the Seekers pair, that Sex Instruction, Information and Education Committee of the U.S. Dr. Lester Kirkendall, we'll deal with him later on, and Dr. Mary Calderon. B.F. Skinner, he's the father of modern behaviorism. He's the man who wrote that book, Beyond Freedom and Dignity. We'll touch on him later. And Dr. William Glasser, he's the man who set up the schools without failure. He had worked among delinquent girls, and he said that most of the problems with delinquents arise from the fact that they are made to feel outcasts, that they suffer failure. And they mainly suffer failure at school. He was the originator also of reality therapy. He says that the mentally ill ought to get off their tails and fix themselves up. It rests with them. But he set up the Schools Without Failure, and he wrote a book called Schools Without Failure, well worth reading. I think fundamental to what we're going to talk about is an entirely new concept of mental health. Mental health is defined by certain of these humanists in, not in the usual terms, but in social terms. There are two statements here emanating from the World Health Organization. One is from Alger Hiss, who was exposed by Whittaker Chambers as being a communist during the McCarthy inquiries. He said health is a state of complete physical, mental and social well-being and not merely the absence of disease or infirmity. This is now accepted as the WHO definition of health. And they bring in the social all the time. And Brock Chisholm, who headed up WHO, said universal mental health means one world. In other words, if you don't believe in what we believe in, then you can't be very well mentally. I'm going to show you here a series of quotes. Each of them defines mental illness. Each of them is uttered by a humanist. Here's your first one. Mental illness was said by John Dewey. I will read you the full quote. He said, this is speaking about personal independence. It often makes an individual so insensitive in his relations to others as to develop an illusion of being really able to stand and act alone, an unnamed form of insanity. The second quote is from Paul Brandwine. He wrote this book, Concepts and Values, that is approved as part of the social studies in Maryland and some other states. He said, any child who believes in God is mentally ill. The third, from Brock Chisholm, whom we quoted before, now he spells it out. Those who do not believe in a one-world government are mentally ill. And Ashley Montague, he says that the American family structure produces mentally ill children. Now remember that the 11th affirmation of the First Humanist Manifesto said, we assume that humanism will take the path of social and mental hygiene. There's a book been written about this. So we've got this concept today of the teacher as psychotherapist. Children are ill when they come to school with the values of their parents, so they've got to be made well. Today's Education, which is the National Education Association Journal of January 1969, and on page 30 says, between 1970 and 1980, the basic role of the teacher will change noticeably. 10 years hence, it should be more accurate to term him a learning clinician. And it says this is intended to convey the idea that schools are becoming clinics to provide individualized psychosocial treatment, in inverted commas, for the student, thus increasing his value both to himself and society. So here we have education moving into the affective domain, into the domain of ideas and values and thoughts and internal feelings. And it moved in there by the use of the methods of third force psychology. We may have a chance to talk about that later. In 1967, the U.S. Office of Education funded 9 teacher education model programs, and they were called Behavioral Science Teacher Education Program. Now, this is called BSTEP by the people in the U.S., B-S-T-E-P. Now, these instruct teachers in the use of behavioral scientist techniques which were developed for treating the mentally ill and the criminally defective. And they include such things as role-playing, psychodramas, sociodramas, behavior modification. Behavior modification is a modern definition, particularly in the U.S., of education. Modification of behavior. Simulation games, humanistic awareness training, and what's called the magic circle. They developed people called change agents. There are individual people who'd been trained to affect social change. There's an Office of Education document called Pace Setters in Innovation. And it explains the techniques. It's an article in the Diamondback, which is a student's magazine from the University of Maryland. It explains how the racial attitudes of students were measured on a situation attitude scale, these SAS scales they use. And then it says that change agents were able to, quote, bring students through progressive changes of stages of attitudinal change without their being aware of it. And it also says that change agents learn to identify elements in schools and communities that resist new ideas and how to overcome these forces without their being aware of it. Now, if they can do that, we have to ask the question what religious or political attitudes can also be changed without the subjects being aware of it. If you're going to change attitudes, you first must find out what they are. And these are the ways that attitudes are assessed. There are various tactics, but these are some of them. The magic circle, for example, is one where the students sit in this magic circle and they pour out themselves to each other. Nothing is held back. They call each other names and everything else. The second is this interpersonal relationship thing, which is somewhat similar, very often works through another idea, which is the diary thing, where you communicate utterly with others. The third is called inside out, and this has to deal with situations. Supposing you are a member of a family of which the parents have just been divorced. You talk about that. Then there's the who comes to your house game. Is he black? Is he yellow? How is he treated? How is he greeted? Then these diaries that are kept about home. How much is spent on food? How much on grog? And this sort of thing. Does your mother go out with other men? Does your father go out with other women? And are there any conflicts in the home? They deal with conflicts between children, for example, and these are all kept in diaries and logbooks. Now, these diaries are not supposed to have any right answers in. These diaries are just the outpouring of the feelings of the child, and they are privileged knowledge between the child and the teacher. And they sit down and they discuss these things, and the teacher can assess precisely what that child is and where that child is going. The open-ended questions, I get angry when, and they write this all down. The role-playing, sociodramas, people come into the schools and they put on these plays. There's one account of one I have in a book that says that there was a murder and there were shouts of white trash repeated after this. And some of the children become so upset by these things that they need psychiatric treatment. Then this idea of conceptualized social studies, and this is the Makos-Simp sort of thing we're talking about. They are phasing out the chronological, factual part of history. They don't deal with persons and events anymore. Some teachers say that this takes away the perspective and therefore it takes away the history. But they're all psychologically based and they are based on the methods of third force psychology. So we come to a thing called values education. And there are three basic assumptions in this, right throughout the whole of it. The first is that religion, the family, and society have all failed to convey the necessary values to children. And so the teacher is going to do it. And this is written in Makos in so many words. Secondly, the values necessary for children are those derived from considerations of expedience and so-called necessity. Makos says that the only values are survival values, those values which help a person to survive. So they are humanist values. Thirdly, a person can find an effective set of values unaided and unguided by his culture. This is assumed, because the teacher must not give any direction and must not approve nor disapprove. Non-directive, non-judgmental is the name of the game. I don't think there's any man who, unaided, can in his lifetime give himself an adequate set of values on his own. We all depend so much on those who've gone before us. Not so much on the philosophers, not on the theologian. We depend on the men who have exercised their intellect in the way that man does, through trial and error, and who have found a set of values that work. Back in the 12th century, Bernard of Chartres wrote, "We are like dwarves seated on the shoulders of giants. We see further than the ancients, and we see things more clearly than they. But this is not because we are of greater stature, nor because we have a greater sharpness of vision, but because we are raised and borne aloft on that giant mass. We are carried upon the shoulders of those who've gone before us in all our values, one way or another. We have set principles, but we also have the experimentation that brings about a culture." So I consider all three of these assumptions to be false. Now again, with false assumptions, the best process can only give you false conclusions. If the assumption is incorrect and the logic is perfect, the conclusion must be false. In values education, the US federal government, through the National Endowment for the Humanities, has funded a 3-year pilot program called the Ethical Quest in a Democratic Society. It's programmed into social studies, into language arts and health curriculum. The children in these courses confront value conflicts. Now what they do is they give them the conflicts in the course material and then they concrete these down into some contemporary version of the same moral dilemma. They face the children with a moral dilemma and they give them no guidance. The children must make up their own minds. Now, the wisest of adults cannot solve moral dilemmas sometimes, but they are taught there's no right answer, there's no wrong answer, there may be no answer at all. This is what they're taught in the course. The teachers are taught this. Now, there are dangers in this. Firstly, it leans very heavily on the teacher's own preferences. And he will push these preferences and he'll exclude all other alternatives. Or else, because he is trying to remain objective, he'll present all values as equally valid. And that's moral relativism, and that's where we always finish up. We either finish up with the children being manipulated by the teacher's own values or in moral relativism. Louis Rath and Merrill Harmon and Sidney Simon are the people who are responsible for a system of values clarification, how you find a value. There are three major steps in finding a value. This is the system of Rath and Simon. Sidney Simon is a very interesting guy. He was told not to teach this in some schools, and he said, I sneaked it in, I call it something else. And he said that children should be protected from the moralistic crap. Now, first of all, they say a value must be, firstly, freely chosen, and chosen from alternatives, from among alternatives. Now, this is done without guidance. And chosen after careful consideration of the consequences of each alternative. Now, how can children of 10 and 11, and this is the age to which these courses are directed, possibly know the consequences of the alternatives put to them? Fourthly, the value must be prized or cherished. It's a value that you must be pleased to accept. You must accept it with joy. And then you must publicly affirm it. This makes it very difficult to change your mind. And then you must act upon it, and then you must act upon it regularly so it becomes a pattern for your life. Now, once any value has gone through that process, that is your value mate. That's it. So if you can put through that process the act of murder, then that is a valid value for you, and you must accept it and live by it. You must act upon it regularly. Here again we have the story of value conflicts, and we have the story of moral dilemmas. I quote you a couple. There's one strategy called the Alligator River story. This is about a young girl who wants to get across a river to meet her lover. But the river's full of alligators. And the boatman comes along and he says, okay, I'll take you across if you submit to me sexually. So she has a good look at this, in the back of her head, no doubt, and she said, well, yes, all right. So then he takes her across and she meets her lover and she tells him what happened. And he rejects her over this. So she goes off and she gets a couple of other people to beat him up. Then the children are asked, did she do right or did she not do right? And 80-odd% of them said she did the right thing. Then they have the survival game. We're down in an air raid shelter and we've got food for six and water for six. A bomb has dropped and no one can go outside, but six other people have rushed in. Now here are the people. And all the characteristics of the people are given. 12 people, enough food for six, enough water for six, who gets killed? That's the question. So kids of 10 or 11 are asked to decide which ones get killed. And you've got the pregnant woman who's going to create a problem very shortly with another mouth to feed, and then you've got the athlete who eats too much and he's got to go. This is the way they do it. They go through this. And this has been prohibited by law in some states in the US, this sort of game. Now Makos says, as I mentioned before, that survival values are the basis of moral standards. Who survives? And it's always discussed open-endedly, and the teacher mustn't be judgmental, healthy. Now, I think this can only end up in moral skepticism. Children learn that nothing is right or wrong, and if it is right or wrong, you can't decide whether it is right or wrong. There may be no answer at all. That's moral skepticism, and that's not good for children. Now, in this discussion idea, it's just all done in the group. It's all done by the group. They're led under extreme peer group pressure. The strong ones in the group will push their ideas forward, and the weak ones will accept them. So they finish up with group values. Now it is stated in the literature that any value can become legitimate when the group sanctions it. So the emphasis is on teaming, group goals and consensus. We all agree. Group response. And we have this movement towards response as a group, and the system is called group reflexology. They see man as a stimulus reflex machine. And if this is not headed towards one world and one species, I'd like to know what is. And we have this thing called sensitivity training. It takes many forms, and I'll give you a list of some of them. T-groups, or that's normally training groups, of course. Group dynamics, autocriticism. Now, autocriticism is what's used in the communist countries and used to be used in some monasteries at one time, where you gather around in the circle and you say what you've done that you think you ought not to have done. Operant conditioning. Now, the operant is the child. He's conditioned. The synonym games come from the Eusychian network that I showed on the other slide. This is situated Big Sur. Some people call it Big Sur because they have these, the Esalen Institute there and the Synanon Institute. Human relations, well, you know all about that. Basic encounter, broad sensitivity, group counseling. Group counseling is used in psychiatry, and it's used for good purposes. But used on healthy people, there is some doubt about whether it's going to do anything for them by way of good, and there's every chance it can do something to them by way of harm. Self-examination, of course, is like the autocriticism, interpersonal relationship means so much. Human potential workshop. So there's some of the forms of sensitivity training. Now, the aims are changed behavior and increased knowledge, and the methods are very much in flux. When you say brainwashing, people say, oh, come on, that's a very emotive word. I was very happy to find that the National Training Laboratories itself used the word. Sensitivity training includes coercive persuasion in the form of thought reform or brainwashing, it comes out and says it, as well as a multitude of less coercive informal patterns. That's in the book Issues in Training, page 47, that was issued by the National Training Laboratories. I have underlined the word brainwashing. Now, the National Education Association was a prime mover behind the NTL experiments in sensitivity training. The NTL itself describes three steps in bringing about this, what it calls integration of attitudes through sensitivity training. First is unfreezing the forces that are resistant to change. And this consists in pouring out the inner self to everybody. The process of unfreezing has this form. Firstly, you remove the supports from the old attitudes. You bring out, everybody brings out his old attitudes, trots them out in front of everybody else. Imagine kids coming to school with the values of their parents. They're accepting them on faith. They haven't the critical knowledge nor the ability to defend them. So they're asked to bring them out in front of everybody, and they remove the supports from them. Secondly, you saturate the environment with the new attitudes. Everything is hammered into them with new attitudes. Thirdly, you minimize the threats from the new attitudes. And fourthly, you maximize the support for the desired change. That's the first stage, unfreezing. At this stage, people are invited, having thrown off all their values, to throw off their clothes as well. And I'm told that in some classes in the US, we have eight-year-olds with their clothes off. But certainly we have this at Esalen. There's a report in the literature of a number of policemen who went through the course. Now, anybody in the US who's going to teach this has got to go through it himself. And if teachers don't do this in some states, they lose their accreditation as teachers. That's the unfreezing process. And then you have the changing process. That's the learning the new attitudes. And then the refreezing, that's integrating the changed attitudes into the rest of the personality. You've got a whole new person. Now, there's little, if any, difference in this from group psychotherapy. And Alan Lockwood says there's no difference. The proponents for this sort of thing are looking now for one conceptual scheme. They want preventive mental health done through combining the psychotherapies, sensitivity training, psychiatric casework, counseling, guidance, and existential psychology. In other words, humanist psychology. And they're confusing the mentally ill with the mentally well. They're mixing them up. They're mixing up psychiatry with psychology. They're mixing up group therapy with counseling. The National Training Laboratories in 1962, in its booklet Issues in Human Relations Training, made a fascinating statement. I've headed this, The Road to Mental Health. I'll read you the full quote. Ill persons reach out for help, while relatively well persons find themselves in a dilemma. Although they appear to behave appropriately and seem normal by most cultural standards, they may actually be in need of mental health care in order to help them change, adapt, and conform to the planned society in which there will be no conflict of attitudes or beliefs. Now, if ever I saw a statement of purpose, that is it. Now, at the end of these sensitivity training courses, they usually have what they call a wrap-up statement, and this is one of them. In the outside world, they are no longer on the same wavelength as you are. You have reached a wavelength not many others have achieved. This is the old Gnosticism. They can't possibly understand unless they have also been in a group. So you've got to go through the group first. They become out of contact with their parents. Now, you've got to ask the question if this is why teachers have got to go through it first, and why parents are asked to go through parent effectiveness training to get them back into communication with their brainwashed children, as somebody said. I have an article that says that sensitivity training can be damaging to teachers who take part in it, particularly if other teachers are involved, as well as to the children. Well, you can imagine, if you're a teacher in a school and you work with another teacher and you've got to tell him what you think of him and what you think of the system and what you think of his little brother, not good for anybody. Now, Brock Chisholm, in a speech in 1945, blamed the hold-up of development of peoples on morality, on the concept of right and wrong. We must get rid of morality, he said. And this is what sensitivity training is about, to get rid of morality. 50,000 people have been through Esalen. That's Big Sur, where it goes on. Now, there are two crucial premises underlying this sort of thing. It's affective education. The first is that process is content. This is taken out of a handbook for teachers in elementary and secondary schools, Division of Human Relations. Process is content. So the method or the means becomes an end in itself. Learning is not what or why, it's how. Someone said it doesn't matter where we're going, so long as we're going there fast. Secondly, in a consideration of values, there's no right or wrong answer. Everyone's answer is right for him. Others should tolerate his viewpoint. Now, this is something I've got to say something about, and this is a mistaken subjectivism that's permeating the world of today, which confuses the person with the idea that he holds. I find this particularly in young people. They only know one degree of certitude, and that's opinion. St. Augustine solved this problem a long time ago. He said, "Love not the vice for the sake of the sinner, nor hate the sinner on account of the vice." If I'm beloved of you and I'm doing something that's evil, he says, don't love that evil for the sake of Nesbitt. On the other hand, don't hate him because he does that. You must love the man and hate the idea if the idea is to be hated. But today, utter confusion, because we live in an era of subjectivism. People don't understand how to make these distinctions. I was talking to people in a school about population, and someone asked me, wasn't homosexuality a good thing because it didn't expand the population? We had love without population. And this got on to an argument where I said that, you know, I disapproved homosexuality. And there must have been six of them said, you are persecuting homosexuals. They cannot separate the person from the idea. Ideas are not a proper object of charity. Ideas have got to stand on their own values, their own arguments. Persons are proper objects of charity. Ideas have never been and never will be. Don't get confused like that, because it's all around us. It's in everything we read. It's mistaken charity towards ideas. Sorry, I'm wasting time. The values clarifiers have been sued in one case in the US because they're using behavior modification techniques. That's written up in an article called Simon versus Kohlberg in Exchange. In one study in the US, 24% of the boys who were in this sort of thing demonstrated negative psychological change. So this raised a bit of a smell. And values clarification and values formation became something of a dirty series of words. And we came back to what's called cognitive moral education. And this is based mainly around a very popular figure, Lawrence Kohlberg. Now, he studied
72 boys, and he tried to find out the stages by which they undertook moral development. He got 6 stages out of this, and he can't show how progress is made from one stage to the other. 4 stages come out of his research. Now, he's based this on his own research, on the work of Piaget, on Dewey's theory of education, on the philosophy of Dewey and Kant. Kant was another becoming man. He said that man can't reason. He moves only by moral imperatives known to him. And the liberal social contract theory of Rousseau, and the British school of analytic ethics. Now, that is the basis for Kohlberg. He says that justice is the root of all things. That is the core of his morality. He sees no relationship between morality and charity, for example. So here are his stages of moral development. Firstly, in his pre-conventional stage, he says that we obey rules rather to avoid punishment. There's a set series of rules imposed upon us, and we do what these rules lay on us, or otherwise we'll be punished. That is the infantile response. Then he says there are 5 stages of conformity. The first, we conform to obtain rewards or have favours returned. This, by the way, is his own summation of his scientific system. Then we conform to avoid disapproval or dislike by others, and then to avoid censure by legitimate authorities and resultant guilt. Now, this is the Christian position. Christian morality refers always to authority. It has the internal motivation and motivation as well. The movement is inside us in that law which God said he built into us. He will write into our hearts and on our minds. Scientifically, that's called synderesis. That is the natural knowledge of the natural law of things. And then we have the external authority. Now, this is very much akin to the law. You have the statute law, and then you have the court. And the court decides whether, in this instance which has been brought before it, the act has conformed or conflicted with the known law. And that's the act of conscience. So you've got to have authority to have Christian morality. But Kohlberg goes beyond that. He has 2 other stages of moral development, which he sees as superior. In the 5th, we conform to maintain respect of the impartial spectator, judging in terms of community welfare. In other words, has our act been towards the common good? And his last is our conforming to avoid self-condemnation. So we act out of self-respect. Kohlberg says the 10 commandments are morally pretentious. No doubt God's looking forward to the day when he can explain them to him. He says when we get to level 6, we will be adrift back towards absolutes, towards the spiritual, towards values, if you like. He says that at levels 5 and 6, there is a clear awareness of the relativism of personal values, that morality is autonomous and situational. That's precisely what the Second Humanist Manifesto said in its 3rd affirmation. Level 6 moral reasoning, says Kohlberg, is not incompatible with premarital sex or adultery. Now, the core, as I've said, of his morality is justice. Now, I can see that if you have premarital sex with consent on both sides, and you don't have a child resulting from this, that justice would not be breached. But I cannot see how he can align this with adultery, because there's always injustice to the other partner of the marriage. I cannot follow his reasoning there at all. Kohlberg concludes that moral education should consist in showing children how to think logically about moral dilemmas. Here we go again. Group discussion of these dilemmas, he talks about, in a values-neutral climate. Nobody judges. The teacher keeps the discussion moving and introduces the concepts of the next higher level for more advanced pupils. The teacher is only a facilitator. So we're back to values clarification, back to no wrong answers, etc. And this has got to lead to confusion in the kids. Kohlberg admits the shortcomings of his methods. There's been an interesting development in the US, and that is the use of psychoactive drugs in schools on normal children. I want to read you three prophecies. The first was in the NEA Forecast 70, that journal I quoted you before, January 1969, page 30. Biochemical and psychological medication of learning is likely to increase. Drugs will be introduced experimentally to improve the learning qualities such as personality. Drugs improving personality, and personality being a learning quality. Concentration and memory. The application of biochemical research findings could be a source of conspicuous controversy when children become the object of experimentation. Second quote from the Hawaii Master Plan for Education. Schools will be swept into a whole new area of collaboration with biochemists and psychologists. And this will be a source of conspicuous controversy when children become the objects of such experimentation. They read it somewhere. There will be considerable protest on the part of parents when children are subjected to these drugs, and this parental protest must be overcome. The third quote is from Bertrand Russell and the impact of science on society. Diet, injections and injunctions will combine from a very early age to produce the sort of character, the sort of beliefs that authorities consider desirable. Any serious criticism of the powers that be will become psychologically impossible. Even if all are miserable, all will believe themselves happy because the government will tell them that they are so. That's the prophets. This is the reality. Medication administered to normal children, I quote from Dr. Joseph Bean, Public Education, River of Perdition, published in 1971, page 14. Drugs at the suggestion and sometimes the demand of school authorities are now used on upwards of 3 million students in schools in the United States for such reasons as problems with learning, overactivity, assumed hyperkinesis, minimal brain damage, and to achieve behavioral change, memory lengthening, and attention span lengthening. The number of children on drugs could grow to 4 million, Congress was told in September. That would be September 1970, judging from the date of his book. One school district has reported 35% of its students on such medication. The National Institute of Health has given grants to provide behavior-modifying drugs and physicians to administer these drugs to local school districts. Now, I can only touch very briefly on sex education. The Sex Information Educational Council of the U.S., we referred to these people. That's headed by Dr. Mary Calderon. She formerly worked for Planned Parenthood World Population. She said babies were an epidemic. And in 1974, she shared the Humanist of the Year Award with Joseph Fletcher, who's a situation ethicist. The second member we mentioned was Dr. Lester Kirkendall. He's a board member of CECAS, an officer of the American Humanist Association, and one of the editors of Humanist. He's on the editorial board. He says the moral code must concentrate upon what behavior, attitudes, and experiences will do to actualize man's sociality, rather than upon maintaining prescribed or proscribed patterns of behavior. He was counseling those who have difficulty in getting sex education to school when he said, just sneak it in. He's also an editorial consultant of Sexology magazine and a board member of the American Association of Sex Educators, Counselors and Therapists. CECAS is associated with a whole sexology culture in the U.S., including the Elysium Institute, quote, whose purpose is research and dissemination of information in the behavioral sciences relating to nudity and the body taboo neuroses so prevalent in our culture. The CECAS objectives of sex education parallel remarkably the Elysium Institute aims and goals. Now, it's interesting that the Elysium Institute came first. It was incorporated on the 24th of February, 61, and CECAS was incorporated on 29th of April, 64, to offer, quote, sex education as a positive alternative to legal control of pornography. There are some other sex educators in this scene. One's Anson Mount, who's the public affairs manager of Playboy magazine. He says, right and wrong in the old sense is dead. That premarital sex is dangerous as old hat. Guilt feelings about illicit sex are ridiculous.
The older generation is unqualified to judge. Children are being taught this. There's a series of booklets brought out by the Xerox company that tells the children that they are the wisest and the best informed children of any generation. Their parents are nice old dears and to be loved, but don't take much notice of them, because after all it's your parents and those of their age who've ruined the world. We'll fix it up. Ashley Montague, it's a gentleman named Israel Ehrenberg, was his original name, and he is old and he's the idol of young America. He's a biologist. He says young unmarried individuals who are sufficiently responsible, that means they won't get the girl pregnant, will be able to enter into responsible sexual relationships in a perfectly healthy and morally acceptable and reciprocally beneficial manner, which will help the participants to become more fully developed human persons, human beings. That's in his book, The Pill, the Sexual Revolution in the Schools. Now, some of the language used in these films and books that are going into schools and in this country coming from Seekers would get an adult arrested if he uttered them in public. One of their films I have seen was an X-rater, no question about that. And worse, some of the articles that I've read in these things would be seriously inflammatory to young people. There's a story of one lad who came home and raped his 7-year-old sister simply to get the practice of which he'd been given the theory. I have some quotes here from 5 eminent doctors who say sex education for young people is psychologically damaging. I'll touch briefly only on this. They're looking for earlier access to children by teachers. This NEA forecast said, as non-school preschool programs begin to operate, educators will assume a formal responsibility for children when they reach 2 years old. Dr. Reginald Lurie, who is the president of the Joint Commission on Mental Health of Children, which reported to the president in June 1969, says maybe we can't trust the family alone to prepare young children for this new kind of world. The Soviets have long recognized the shortcomings of the family. Well, long before that, of course, the Communist Manifesto said we have to get rid of the family. They felt they needed to have access to the babies. During the first 18 months, the brain is growing faster than it ever will again. It is then also more plastic and most available for appropriate experience and corrective interventions. So we're back to 18 months. The White House conference in Washington, December 70, said a daycare program that ministers to a child from 6 months to 6 years has over 8,000 hours to teach him values, fears, beliefs and behaviors. And Dr. B.F. Skinner, who wrote Beyond Freedom and Dignity and said we are entitled to neither, and raised his own daughter for the first 2.5 years of her age naked in a glass cage, says of him, Dr. Bean says that he would lock in every child at birth to a precise, standardized, mechanized way of growing up, producing in the end a society worldwide without individual freedom and dignity, an anthill civilization of robotized humans. So we're down to birth now, but that's not all. The Joint Commission on Mental Health of Children, the child advocate, psychologist, social technician, whatever that is, and medical technician, should all reach aggressively into the community. Send workers out to children's homes, recreation facilities and schools. Assume full responsibility for all education, including pre-primary education, parent education and community education. Here it comes. Every child and youth in America from conception, and it spells this out 9 months before birth for those who didn't know, through age 24 are to be included. So we begin at conception. Bertrand Russell, again in The Impact of Science on Society, said it is for future scientists to discover exactly how much it costs per head to make children believe that snow is black, and how much less it would cost to make them believe it is dark grey. When the technique has been perfected, every government that has been in charge of education for a generation will be able to control its subjects without the needs of armies or policemen. So that, ladies and gentlemen, is the brave new world to which new education is heading your children. Now, there's a small number of people in the community who know about this, something less than 15%, I would think, maybe less in Australia. The others won't know what hit them or their children.